This podcast of The Business is a production of KCRW Santa Monica at 89.9 FM, webcast at kcrw.com, and distributed by NPR.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, and prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, we revisit our conversation with superstar film composer Danny Elfman about what it takes to make great movie music. He scored the new live version of the classic Charlotte's Web that Paramount released earlier this month. Plus, red carpet madness with one of the stars of Charlotte's Web. Don't go anywhere. It's The Business from NPR. When you go to the local Cineplex, you're going to watch a movie, not listen to it. But there's so much in a film that you hear, not see. The music, for instance. But music can make or break a movie as much as any visual element. Consider this happy beach scene and how it changes when the music changes. Music is one of those cinematic elements that's only doing its job well if you don't notice it. And great film music can help make a film great.
I could think of a million movies where the music made the movie. I think of Lawrence of Arabia. The Godfather, Nino Rota's score. All the incredible stuff that Bernard Herrmann did, you know, from Citizen Kane to North by Northwest to Psycho.
Have there been instances where the music unmade the movie, so to speak?
Oh, yeah. A million, and I'm not going to name any of them.
In the last 20 years, Danny Elfman's music has helped make the movie many, many times. He's written maybe 100 scores, including most of Tim Burton's films, from Batman to Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and some of the most recognizable music in TV history, like the theme to The Simpsons. He's been nominated for a slew of Oscars, Emmys, and other statues and plaques, but he started his music career as a Paris street busker, and then the leader of the new wave slash punk band Oingo Boingo.
Six, seven years into having a rock band, Tim Burton and Paul Rubens appear and asked me if I'm interested in writing music for a movie. Never occurred to me before. And I went home and I wrote a piece of music and recorded it, sent it to them, and never thought about it, you know, and then went back to work. I got a call, I don't know, a week or two later saying I was hired. And this was like the defining moment, because when I got the news, I told my manager that, nah, I'm not going to do it. I like them too much to take this on and ruin their movie. I thought about it and I woke up in the morning and I said, what the hell? You know, it's on their shoulders.
Elfman's music sounds like nothing you've heard before, but he insists that, like all film scores, it relies to a certain degree on the tropes that were invented by the first film composers, like Franz Waxman, who did Bride of Frankenstein, Max Steiner, who scored the original King Kong, and Eric Korngold, who came up with the music for all those early swashbucklers.
The amazing thing to me is that they had nothing to go on. There was no guidelines to say, what do we put under action or narrative? How do we show emotion? What do we show for tension? They were inventing it on the spot. And what made them come up with the fact that holding long strings for a tense moment and letting it build and build with the orchestra until you have your shock moment, or misleading us with a little melody that might make us think that things are just fine and plodding along, and suddenly, wham, something happens because the melody was misleading us into thinking that nothing was going to happen. And or staccato strings providing energy in a way, brass and horns with blustery fanfares, which give us a sense of heroism.
Movie music not only creates and manipulates mood, it's there to accentuate actions.
You're in a scene where you've already decided that there's 20 things that the music has to catch exactly as you're seeing it. Door slams, the bicycle hits the street, the music's got to do something, and it takes off, and it's got to take off, and then it's going to slam into something else, the music's got to stop, and then there's going to be like a tension, 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 and boom, something's going to go off, and then something's going to fall, and then you want to catch all of that with the music.
Elfman, like every working composer, has his own process for writing film music. But it all starts with watching a rough cut of the film and then being able to grab at a musical idea whenever and wherever it strikes.
Tim flew me out to the Batman set in London, and I'm on a 747 on the way home. And the theme that became Batman's theme suddenly started playing in my head. I mean, it played itself out as clearly as if it were playing in the theater. So I got a tape recorder that I learned never to travel without, and I run into the bathroom. And I'm trying to lay it out in a way that it'll make sense to me later, but these 747s are really loud. And the bathrooms in particular are really loud, and I can't just sit there in my seat and start singing. You know, it's just, I'll be the crazy guy on the plane. So I'm running to the bathroom over and over and over again. Now the stewardess is getting nervous. Sir, are you okay? Oh, yeah, yeah, I'm fine. Are you sick? Is there anything we can get you? No, 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 I'm fine. And now I can see them talking to each other. And it's like, obviously this guy's a junkie. Like, what's he doing? He's going in there shooting up. What is he doing? He's like been in there. He says he's not sick, and he's going in every 10 minutes. And I'm trying to lay it out like, okay, so snare drum, celli, boom, 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 and I'm trying to lay out like a big pitch, and I'm going French horns, boom, 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 and obviously what I'm singing in the tape recorder is all meant to enable me later to remember that piece of music, because I know that I'm going to land and I'm going to forget it, because they're going to play landing music when they hit the floor, and it's going to erase everything. They're going to play a piece of Muzak when they hit the tarmac, and it's going to be like a Danny Elfman brain eraser. And then I'll be going home, what was I thinking? It's going to become that fish that got away. So I get home, and I turn on my tape recorder, and mainly what I'm hearing is just enormous roar and a little bit in the background. And my first couple times through, going, it's gone. I can't get a sense of what was. And then I listened to it about 10 more times. It was just enough. And then it came back. The whole thing just came back in my head. And I was at the piano and I got the whole thing down. And it, in fact, became the main titles to Batman.
Back in the day, a composer would have to sit down at the piano and play the theme he created for a director. But these days, composers use a sequencer, a keyboard synthesizer connected to a computer program that can mock up the sound of an entire orchestra and play precisely to film images on a computer monitor.
It's a great tool because the director can actually sit there and go, oh yeah, that sounds very exciting, I like that, or no, I don't like that part, before you are in front of an orchestra, that you can kind of work it out with them.
Like his music, Danny Elfman's home in Los Angeles reflects his Baroque sensibilities. There's a complete monkey skeleton in the living room, on the coffee table. Actual shrunken human heads sit atop the baby grand. Walk down the stairs to his basement studio, and you're greeted by an assortment of antique prosthetic legs, arms, and hands. The studio itself is draped in red velvet and looks a little like the lair of the Phantom of the Opera, with Elfman playing the role of the mad genius facing an altar of keyboards, monitors, and mixing consoles. He's currently working on the score of a new live-action version of the classic Charlotte's Web.
So, I'm playing her theme for the first time, but I'm using pianos, I'm using celestes, I'm using bells, because we're seeing her legs moving, 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 moving. She's weaving, 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 and there's a loose strand of web. Now I'm telling the audience that that means something. She has an idea. Now I'm getting more emphatic, and I'm playing her theme for the first time full out that we're going to hear. Now she's beginning to fly around, and she's got a plan. We don't know what it is yet. She's cutting and snipping. I'm giving emphasis to big cuts and big snips to help give it a little more power to the movements that she's doing. And then finally we pan back and we see a moon against a web, and we don't yet know what she's done. This is all synthesizers you're hearing. And in a week, this will all be played again on with a real orchestra and will sound much better. Mm-hmm. But yet, this is close enough for the director to sit here with me, listen to the piece, and we could talk through the whole thing, work out all the beats. By the way, my goal, I should add, with these mock-ups, is that there's as little disagreement in front of a 90-piece orchestra as there possibly can be. Because with that many players, you don't want to be arguing about how this hits and how that hits and if this is big enough or if this is strong enough or if that should get smaller. You hopefully want to have all that here in a room with just me and a director and a bunch of synthesizers which aren't running on the union clock of costing a fortune every hour.
You may not have heard of Harry Gregson-Williams or James Newton Howard, but they're among an elite group of maybe 15 guys who write the lion's share of all big-budget film scores. And yes, I did say guys. The vast majority of studio film composers are men. While there are no monogamous relationships, many composers are known for their work with particular directors. In his 20-year film composing career, Danny Elfman has worked with director Tim Burton on at least 10 films. One reason for these kinds of collaborations is a shared creative sensibility and a kind of shorthand that develops between the director and the composer. Another is simply knowing what to expect.
There are certain things that go along with being a composer that probably most composers have to deal with, I'm guessing. One of them is the extremely idiosyncratic nature of directors, and the fact that you're going to have to deal with all their insecurities. And most directors are, understandably so, they've been working for a year to 2 years of their life on this one thing, and here they are in the 11th hour, it's almost done, and now they're getting bombarded with outside input that they never had from a studio, from different people, and worst of all, from a dozen or a couple dozen people out of a preview audience who've been elected to become film critics.
The larger a film's budget, the more nervous a studio can get. The guys in suits start trusting the artists less and focus groups more. And that can play hell with a composer's workday.
A lot of scores are getting thrown out more and more these days. You know, when a movie runs into a bit of trouble, there's not much else you can do. You know, you throw out music and try putting another music. Saying the audiences, we're not getting the numbers high enough. What can we do? We can't throw anything else out. Throw out the music. And that, all too frequently, the music ends up being the target, because there is no other target. Once again, there's only two things you can change by the time you're previewing a movie. You can re-edit, or you can change the score.
One of a composer's other biggest nightmares is when a director falls in love with the music they've used before the score was written.
You know, every movie, when it starts previewing, right, when a composer is coming on, the movie's done, they're starting to edit and preview, they're putting in a temp score, which means they have to put in music to preview it for an audience. And the director is going to be living with this temp score from anywhere between 3 and maybe 6 months. Now, some directors are going to get hopelessly attached to that temp score, and it's going to prove to be a major problem. And I know that the project is going to become a real bitch.
Composers of major film scores make somewhere in the vicinity of $100,000 to $200,000 a score. Directors are paying for a composer's particular sound and sensibility. But it's not just artistry that earns them the big bucks. It's grace under fire. Since they almost always begin work after a film is shot, it's a matter of, be a genius a little faster, would you?
We're in a pressure cooker. We're dealing with a lot of hysteria often. Sometimes it's a virtual battlefield between producers and studios and directors, and you're in the middle of it. And you have to be able to deliver the goods. You can't implode. You can't collapse. And you can't even conceive of not delivering. So all of us have the same thing in common. If we've succeeded, we've shown under fire, under battle, that we can deliver, regardless of the pressure. If we say we're going to deliver a score, we're going to deliver a score.
director idiosyncrasies, studio insecurities, and the ticking clock all make the process of composing music for film an utter crapshoot.
You know, you never know when you start on a film. Is it going to be a pleasurable project, or is it literally going to make you want to kill yourself? You know, and I've been on both. I've been on movies that I come out of it and go, that was really hard work, but it was so enjoyable and fulfilling. And I've been on movies where I've had to tell my wife to hide the ammo, keep sharp objects away from me, and take the keys from the car, because if I don't kill myself, I'm going to go out on a tri-state killing spree and take down 12 other people.
I'm going to go into the park at night with piano wire and people are going to get hurt.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, because this director is going to make me insane.
But perhaps the biggest challenge isn't the competition with those composing today. It's with those who are already decomposed.
I was driving home and listening to the classical music channel, and I'm hearing a piece of music that I didn't recognize. And I think to myself, oh my God, what movie is this from? This is the most amazing piece of film music I'd ever heard. And I thought it had to be film music because it was starting and stopping and lunging about. And I sat outside my house, and I can't go in the house. I have to wait till the end of the piece and find out who did it. And I'm already rolling this around in my head. I'm going, you know, if this is one of my contemporaries, I quit right now, because I'll never be able to write a score like this. Of course, it was Shostakovich.
Of course, Dmitri Shostakovich was working long before Hollywood was absorbed by modern media monoliths. He only had to deal with the wannabe tyrants, like Joseph Stalin. Not the truly power mad, like today's directors, producers, and studio executives. To take us to the break, here's some of Danny Elfman's best known music from film and television. Coming up after a short break, the Red Carpet Blues. You're listening to The Business from NPR. This is The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. The premiere of the Douglas Fairbanks version of Robin Hood in 1922 created a new Hollywood tradition, the red carpet premiere. It was replete with everything we've come to expect from opening night. The red carpet, of course, limousines, elegantly attired stars, a throng of adoring fans, and a sea of flashing bulbs. The tradition's been de rigueur ever since, but at this point, when there's a red carpet for the opening of every suburban supermarket, it seems like there's nothing really all that special about them anymore. Last year, Nancy Miller sent us this report from the red carpet premiere of Dreamer, DreamWorks' Black Beauty-style kid flick. Note that the star of this film is also, coincidentally, the star of Charlotte's Web, which came out earlier this month.
I'm standing along a two-block stretch of red carpet in front of the Bruin Theater in West L.A. Hundreds of reporters, photographers, and TV camera crews are jockeying for position behind metal barricades in the blazing afternoon sun. We're all here to get a moment with Hollywood's latest It Girl, an A-list actress whose co-stars have included Cruz, De Niro, and Denzel. It would be near impossible for most of us here to ever get a one-on-one with her, so this event is do or die. Everyone's negotiated with the studio for the best spot they can get, and now there's nothing to do but stand and wait. Wait for maybe 30 seconds of inane chatter from a celebrity who, like us, doesn't really want to be here. Dade Hayes is a senior editor at Entertainment Weekly.
So it's kind of this strange spectacle. It's been with us for a long time in Hollywood, but it's become a lot more kind of streamlined and businesslike, and there's a calculation, I think, that goes into who talks to whom and for how long and in what way that didn't exist, you know, even maybe 10 or 15 years ago.
According to the established pecking order, my placement this afternoon is so-so. Not quite the international press hinterlands at the end, but not the choice center spot the TV crews always get either. I'm next to a freelancer from Life and Style magazine.
Sometimes it's frustrating when it gets to people don't stop to talk, you know. The earlier they come, the more likely they are to talk. If it's like kind of near the time when the premiere is starting, they just do the photos and they wave and then you don't get anything, and that's annoying.
But like any party, the people who arrive early are just B-list filler. So, as usual, the press has arrived here 2 hours early, and the star we're all waiting for will probably be 2 hours late. But even if you do land the big stars, you tend to get canned crap. What are the actors going to say, anyway? The director was a nightmare. This movie sucks. I just got out of rehab, and yes, I'm gay. Actors are subjected to a groundhog day of lame questions along the red carpet. Who are you wearing? How are you feeling? What's your next project? Dade Hayes of Entertainment Weekly.
So it's just a constant exercise in sort of pandering on some level, you know, kind of trying to think of questions that are not going to put them off, but also trying to seem appealing and like someone that they'd want to come and talk to, but also protecting your turf and being competitive and, you know, jockeying for position because, again, you're next to your competitors.
Finally, after waiting around for an hour, a caravan of rented stretch limos arrive at the head of the red carpet. The cast begins to emerge from their cars and are escorted by their PR people murmuring into headsets. The order of appearance is carefully choreographed by star power, dimmest to brightest. First, Kris Kristofferson, then Elizabeth Shue, then Kurt Russell, and Russell's longtime gal pal Goldie Hawn. Every star's first stop is a mass photo op from the 50 photographers penned together like a pack of hyenas. Craig Barrett is a freelancer who shoots for the British press.
It is a complete nightmare sometimes. It gets a bit intense. But as long as you don't try and let it worry you too much, don't take it too seriously. You can get very stressed over it, but the amount of years I've been doing it now, it just kind of, I try not to let it worry me too much if I don't get the shot.
So do you do like the sort of shouting thing, or do you just give your British charm to whoever's in?
you try and be controlled as possible, but a lot of time when you've got 10, 15 other people around you shouting, you have to be slightly vocal just to get some sort of eye line.
You'd think they were crashing the party for their own fun and profit, but you'd be wrong.
There's blurred lines between what the public thinks is paparazzi and what are actually bona fide credentialed press photographers. People forget that you're actually invited along from the publicists. The film companies and the studios actually want you there to publicise their film.
So why are so many invited? Because it's all about the hysteria. And speaking of hysteria, here's the moment we've all been waiting for. The woman of the hour has arrived. She emerges from her limo wearing a white shirt and a black bubble skirt, and in great showman style, is plopped down on her titular co-star, a big brown horse. Yes, hundreds of jaded journalists have been waiting in the sun for 11-year-old Moppet Dakota Fanning. She slides off her high horse and begins to make her way towards the crush of reporters. It's another hour before she makes it to our end of the carpet. When she finally arrives, the Life and Style reporter next to me lunges forward, thrusting her tape recorder in Dakota's face. The rest of us stand there, our microphones held out to catch every pearl of wisdom from Dakota's tiny, brace-laced mouth. What follows is the entire interview with Dakota Fanning. It's a minute and a half long, but I wanted to play the whole thing because it really demonstrates everything wrong with the red carpet. A warning. Turn your radio off if you are the least bit squeamish.
Gorgeous.
It's a
beautiful outfit. Thank you. So you must be excited about the big day today.
I am so excited. I can't wait.
How's your horse doing?
Very good. Is it very good?
Yeah, you've been getting a chance to ride a lot?
Yes, a lot.
Good. And are you doing this bee season movie that I'm Life of Bees?
Oh, Super Life of Bees.
Is that something? Is that real?
It's kind of in there. I think it's being like written. It was like kind of talked about. It's not
but
really
you're not yet. So that's not your next thing
yet.
Necessarily?
Not my next thing necessarily.
Well, okay. I know you finished Charlotte's Web. What's
right.
after? So what's next?
Well, I'm not doing the thing right now, if that's
you're
for
doing,
sure. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're just kind of relaxing
exactly.
and waiting for the next big thing. I see
right.
you still have the pink braces
yes.
on. They look so cute.
Thank you.
They look so cute.
Yeah. Charlotte's Web comes out in June, and it's all real animals, so it's really going to be exciting. It's just like the book, so.
It's just like the book. Have you seen any of the footage?
Not yet, I haven't, so I'm really excited to see it.
Do you spoil your horse?
I totally.
What do you do to spoil?
Oh, my gosh. Totally spoiled.
What do you do?
Cookies, all kinds of treats,
uh-huh.
and he has all pink, like, brushes.
Okay.
And
what's the funniest thing you've seen the horse do?
My horse?
Yeah.
He looks in the mirror, like, every time, like, we ride around the rink, he always, like, looks.
So he's got kind of like a narcissistic complex a little bit. All right. Is there a comic strip or a cartoon that you think is like your life?
A little bit. I don't know. I'm so lucky to do what I'm doing. I mean, I can't imagine it.
I can't imagine a cartoon version of it.
Right.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Dakota.
All that waiting and all that sycophancy, and this is as good as it gets. And in the end, this premiere will get maybe 3 seconds on a TV show, maybe a half inch of column space in a magazine, and the reporter will get maybe $50. Considering the millions spent by studios, it just doesn't seem worth it. But EW's Dade Hayes disagrees.
If fewer media outlets cared and covered these things, you know, then yes, it would be really the decline of the premiere, and it would maybe be on its way out. But au contraire, it seems like more people are interested than ever, and that's what kind of animates the whole occasion. As disappointing and kind of shopworn as it seems at times, it still is kind of given life by the simple fact that you can get up there, and if you're interviewed by all these people on the red carpet and you're talking on their cell phones like Tom Cruise and other stars love to do, it just creates more heat around the movie, and it's about volume. And if you can be on 200 out of 210 cable channels around the world with your movie, that's the goal.
The stars have gone inside to watch their movie, and the photographers and reporters quickly pack up. After all, tomorrow is another premiere and another $50. For The Business, I'm Nancy Miller.
And that's The Business. Matt Holtzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com and click on KCRW A to Z. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new 7-passenger MDX. More information is available at Acura.com.